You are listening to part one of our interview with Dr. Shante Moling, a specialist in endometriosis treatment and gynecologic surgery on the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. Part two will broadcast in 2 weeks.
I'm Elizabeth Madrigal.
And I'm Karen Morrison.
And we're the hosts of the Women's Mosaic, where the real lives of women and girls are shared and celebrated.
In this space, we honor the feminine and amplify the voices of women speaking their truth.
The Women's Mosaic delves into the real lives of local women through story-rich interviews, learning what works and what doesn't to enhance the health and well-being of women in our community.
We strive to share unique perspectives, resource sharing, and instructions on how to be kind by any means necessary. Welcome to the Women's Mosaic.
Step into your power, feel it rise. No more hiding, no more compromise. You're the light, you're the spark, burning bright. This is your moment, this is your life.
Today we are joined by Dr. Shante Moling. She is a board-certified and fellowship-trained gynecologist and gynecologic surgeon. Welcome to the show, Dr. Moling.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here with you.
Dr. Shante, to start off our conversation, we'd like to ask you to tell us one thing you'd like our listeners to know about you, and this can be anything.
There are so many things. It's hard to choose. I get my sort of my calm and inner strength from nature. And that sounds so trite, really, but it's almost a daily thing to be outside. I have often barred owls in my back area behind my house, and watching their babies is just such a yearly event for me that keeps me going. So that's one little secret to my source of calm and strength.
So your practice is a national level referral center of endometriosis care. Can you tell us what endometriosis is?
Yeah. It's a complex disease, right? It's in many ways, we now are beginning to think of it as a systemic disease, but we have traditionally thought of it as a condition where cells that look similar to cells that line the uterus grow outside the uterus. So they might grow on the ovaries or in the peritoneum. Peritoneum is the skin that lines the body cavity. They often will invade into the uterosacral ligaments, the ligaments behind the uterus and cervix that pass by the bowel, creating some bowel pain. We can have lesions invading up as far as the diaphragm and into the lung. Rare cases, which I haven't seen, cases in the brain, cases in very remote places. The places I usually deal with are the pelvis, the bladder, the bowel, and the diaphragm.
Mm. And these lesions are not cancerous lesions.
They are not.
But they are tissue. And what actually creates the pain?
That's a wonderful question. And it's more like we think we know what creates the pain. And it seems to be a combination of inflammation. So these cells create this massively inflammatory environment with cytokines and mediators of inflammation, as well as the neurologic system. So all the sensory nerves are involved. And these lesions have growth factors for blood vessels, but also growth factors for nerves. So they begin to have their own little array of nerves involved with the lesion, along with blood vessels supporting them and their growth.
And
so
you're
it's
sure.
Not a cancer, but it does spread a little bit in a way that seems like a cancer.
So you're sure men can't get these?
Very rarely it's been found in men.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah. So Which goes against the theory. There's a prevailing theory that we get this from retrograde menstruation. So the concept that when we have a period, we bleed out through the cervix and vagina, but some of that blood goes out the tubes into the body cavity. And so people think that's how we get endometriosis. It's called retrograde menstruation. And there may be some validity to that. I think maybe some cases where that occurs, but we also think that embryogenesis, or as the body, as the fetus is developing in utero, that the cells that follow the track to become the uterus and cervix and fallopian tubes, some of those cells get maybe stuck along the way and they form endometriosis instead of making it all the way to the uterus. A lot of times the disease is found along those embryologic migratory pathways, if you will.
Boy, I had no idea. I think it's more and more, it's more complex than I even realized. And I thought it was pretty complex. So, wow.
Wow. Young women are often told by their mothers and grandmothers that period pain is normal and merely something to endure every month. Is there a genetic link to developing endometriosis? And do we know what causes it?
So, yes, there is a genetic link, and we do not know exactly the gene that causes it, and it may be multifactorial. So there's a genetic predisposition, perhaps, combined with an environment that together predisposes someone to having endometriosis. So, yes, there is a genetic increased risk. Like if your mother had it and your grandmother had it, you have a more greater likelihood of having it. However, you know, we talk about medical gaslighting and we talk about patients who go over and over to providers who tell them their period pain is normal. They normalize it. You need to do, you know, these things to treat your pain. But the truth is family members also gaslight patients and right. people and say, well, I had bad periods too. You just need to go to bed on your period and that's normal, as though this is a normal thing, right? Really, there are so many barriers for a young person feeling that they have pain and trying to recognize that it's not normal and that they actually might get some help from it.
So what percentage of women in the United States do researchers estimate have endometriosis?
10%.
Wow.
Right. It's a fully known entity in terms of that perceived percentage from research. And of course, it's hard to know the true number there. It could be higher. But for patients who have infertility of no certain etiology, at least 50% of them will have endometriosis.
Oh.
And for patients, teenagers with pelvic pain, 80% of them will have endometriosis.
So it isn't usual really for, you know, adolescents to have severe period pain. Because I remember I was debilitated a day a month, if not 2 days a month.
Yes. So in my opinion, that would have deserved a workup.
Right. Right.
You know, but staying home from school, getting gastritis from taking so much ibuprofen, that would indicate to me that there's a problem. And I find stage three plus degree endometriosis in 15-year-olds.
Wow.
And out of how many stages would that be? Three out of four. Wow.
We have an American Society of Reproductive Medicine has a classification system that we have stage one to four. So stage one disease is early, small lesions. You would never see them on ultrasound or MRI usually. And they're on that lining tissue, the peritoneum. And then more widespread on the lining tissue would be stage three. And then when you advance into different conditions within the ovary, the appendix, the bowel, these are the more advanced stages.
So, what are some of the common and not so common symptoms of endometriosis?
Well, classically, we all think of painful periods, right? So that's a very common presenting symptom. Not everyone with endometriosis has dysmenorrhea, but dysmenorrhea, which means painful periods, is one of the classic presenting symptoms. We also have, call them the D's, the four D's. So we have dysuria, so you can get it on the bladder. I've had it full thickness into the bladder, like had to remove a little section of the bladder. It went all the way into the bladder cases. Those are more rare actually than the bowel. So dyschezia, painful bowels, dyschezia, dyspareunia, painful sex, dyspareunia. So patients who have painful, deep penetrative sex very often will have in highly invasive painful lesions at the top of the vagina on the inside and very rarely invading all the way through the vagina. So dyspareunia. And then finally, infertility. But I also see patients with chest pain and they have full thickness disease through the wall of the diaphragm.
Wow.
And recently, someone who coughed blood with her periods and had lesions in her actual lung.
Wow.
So it's a pretty monstrous disease. And beyond what people realize, you know?
You know, I guess it's so crazy to me that, you know, it's such a common condition, which is such a painful condition and such a serious condition, has gotten such a small amount of societal exposure as a problem.
Right. You think about it, it's as common as breast cancer. And yet the funding and research for endometriosis is, you know, a fraction of what we do for breast cancer. And it can be equally devastating on a life. Maybe there's more mortality with breast cancer, but certainly a disruption in many years of a person's reproductive life are impacted. But we're talking about a disease that has to do with pelvic pain, has to do with sex, with bowel movements, with voiding, peeing. These aren't very sexy topics. And it's in women. Furthermore,
Right. It's in women. That's I think
this
that's
is
the
just
big one,
not an
right?
area that's gotten a lot of attention.
Of course not.
You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. We've been talking to renowned gynecologist and gynecologic surgeon, Dr. Shanti Moling, about the treatment of endometriosis in women. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors and then continue our conversation.
Shriners Children's has opened a new pediatric orthopedic clinic in Vancouver. The clinic provides care for children and teens with orthopedic and sports-related injuries. More information is available at shrinerschildrens.org/Vancouver Clinic.
KXRW is supported by The Columbian, which provides coverage of environmental, transportation, and homelessness issues of vital interest to the region and is made possible through its community-funded journalism project via the Local Media Foundation. Available at Columbian.com.
Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. Today, our guest is Dr. Shante Moling, a specialist in endometriosis treatment and gynecological surgery. Our conversation with her continues.
Disorders like irritable bowel syndrome, pelvic inflammatory disease, and interstitial cystitis can mimic the same symptoms as endometriosis. But if endometriosis is suspected, are there specific tests for it or to rule out it, rule out these other conditions?
Yeah, so this is a very good question. So let's break it down. Let me talk first about interstitial cystitis. About 25% of the time, we see interstitial cystitis in the setting of endometriosis. So every time that I do a surgery for endometriosis excision, I also look in the bladder while the person's asleep, same surgery, and make a diagnosis whether they do or do not have obvious signs of interstitial cystitis. So it's a pretty simple test, somewhat overfilling the bladder while they're asleep, holding it for 2 minutes, and then slowly releasing the fluid so that I can watch. And when you see this curtain of little spots that bleed, you have a diagnosis of interstitial cystitis. Now, a lot of urologists will make the diagnosis based on clinical symptoms alone. But I like to make this confirmation partly because then I can immediately, while they're under anesthesia, put a solution in the bladder that stays in for 1 hour that helps kind of heal the lining of the bladder somewhat. And they can continue to do that sort of instillations later. But I like to do it right away, making this full diagnosis. So I do a trifecta, if you will. I look in the body, take out the endo, look in the bladder because it's very common, nearly a quarter of patients have it. And then I also look inside the uterus to make sure that the cavity of the uterus is totally normal and that there aren't polyps contributing to heavy bleeding or a septum creating pain with periods as well. And also a little biopsy to make sure there's no chronic subclinical infection, which also contributes to pain. So when I'm doing a surgery, I'm thinking, okay, this person has pain. Is it endo? Because I don't 100% always know. I have a really good idea based on my exam history and imaging studies. So I'm doing that, but I'm also making sure they don't have a bladder issue and that they don't have any chronic uterine issue as well. The next thing you asked me about was IBS and right. bowel symptoms.
Right.
I would say that at least 90% of my endometriosis patients have some kind of bowel symptom. And most of them have been told that they have IBS. So if someone comes in, they have painful periods, they've been told they have IBS, they have pain with intercourse, I'm thinking they have endo, right?
Right.
Even if they have been given a diagnosis of IBS. So what happens is you have these lesions in the body inside, and they themselves are releasing all this these inflammatory markers that affects the bowels, creating symptoms that are like irritable bowel syndrome, right? So it's like they're not being misdiagnosed with IBS, but they're having symptoms of IBS because of the endometriosis. So a lot of times their symptoms get better, but we also have to look at the gut health, sometimes supplements, sometimes helping improve their microbiome of their gut. So they really go hand in hand.
Studies consistently report prolonged intervals of up to 7 to 10 years between the symptom onset of endometriosis and confirmed diagnosis. Can you explain this delay, particularly for such a chronic and painful condition?
Yeah, isn't that interesting? So I personally think that in this country, providers are not well trained to listen to symptoms of pain, to hear them, and to react as though it's a real thing, right? Mm-hmm. We just, it's because we don't really know how to treat it. We don't know what to do. So most of the people who have endometriosis are starting at the time of menarche. Menarche is that first period. And many of them within a year begin to have symptoms. So they stay home from school, they're unhappy, they maybe go to the ER, maybe they have a cyst that's really just an ovulation cyst. They get told it's their cyst that's causing pain. They get sent home, and most teenagers get put on birth control pills.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least recommended, which then somewhat minimizes the period and helps somewhat with pain enough to function.
Mm-hmm.
And then we kind of brush it off until they go to college, and maybe they decide not to be on the pill. They go off the pill, they have pain again. Or they've been on the pill and it's still not working after years. They keep going back. They keep getting told, well, periods are painful. We can try a different pill. We can try Depo-Provera. You can try the Nexplanon, and never actually addressing the fact that periods really shouldn't hurt this much. And maybe for a few people, they do hurt, but really they should not hurt that much. And so I'm trying to understand why is the key. So I'm a little controversial in that I will operate on teenagers. I have moms who bring in their daughters, and I would say 80% of the time I find endo and very carefully remove it. You know, I have a very meticulous technique. There's minimal bleeding. I don't want to injure any organs. I want to improve their future fertility, not compromise it.
Thank you.
And then a lot of times birth control pills are not well tolerated. And I sometimes think there's a question whether we should be giving these teenagers all these synthetic hormones personally. So I think that there is a delay because one, we just really can't recognize pain. We aren't comfortable sitting and recognizing it. Two, we offer all these Band-Aids that somewhat help for a prolonged period of time, further delaying the diagnosis. And then finally, we don't have enough providers who can necessarily recognize it, even if they do operate. In a young person, sometimes the lesions may look vesicular or clear or maybe hidden underneath an ovary, and they have the disease, but the person going in doesn't know how to recognize it.
Well, I think once a diagnosis is obtained, you're one step ahead, but, you know, getting to that diagnosis, and I know, and it's been studied and it's been confirmed that women's pain is not considered real pain. And so, you know, once a diagnosis is obtained, I mean, you've talked about some of the treatments, but can you tell us about the various treatments that are offered for endometriosis? You know, like from the most, you know, the least invasive to, you know, the cure. I mean, I've heard there is no cure. And then I've heard, oh, yes, there is if you do this and this and this.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's a cure. But I think that there are many treatments, and they're not all treatments that I offer. And so some of them are the basic ones we've already discussed, birth control pill and hormonal contraception. So an IUD with progestin in it, birth control pill, the Nexplanon implant in the arm, Depo-Provera shot. That would be kind of a very baseline level of treatment. Alternative treatments that are in that kind of lowest tier would include nutrition, dietary supplements, a workup with a functional medicine doc. Often they do a full evaluation of the gut for small intestinal bowel overgrowth or intestinal permeability, and treating the gut as part of the problem, sort of a holistic approach. I have patients who are acupuncturists who finally came in after self-treating and managing for years into their 40s with acupuncture, Chinese herbs, lifestyle modification, physical therapy. These things can help manage the pain and get you a certain point, right? There are certain natural supplements that are anti-inflammatory, for example, that can, to some degree, moderate how one feels. And one of them may even very slightly shrink a lesion if you have an endometrioma in one study, an Italian study called N-acetylcysteine. However, we don't have any definitive randomized controlled trials proving that. So these are kind of the first lower tier. The next tier of medication will be something called gonadotropin-releasing hormone analogs. And we have agonists and antagonists Both of these, so the traditional old one is Lupron, the newer one is Elagolix, which is also called Orilissa. And these medications create a chemical menopause. And so they really shut down estrogen. Endometriosis is estrogen mediated. So I believe we have these lesions since birth. We don't really manifest them until menarche, when you begin to have hormonal activity, which feeds them, stimulates their growth and responsiveness and pain. So shutting that system down so we have no estrogen stimulating the lesions does help with pain, but it also creates a menopausal state, some bone loss, and some permanent problems such as the bone loss. And you can only do it for 6 months to 2 years, technically. And when you stop the medications, the problem resumes. You get regrowth of the lesions. So they do suppress, but they don't remove. And so you've had some negative side effects, and then you're back to square one. We have surgical ablation, and this helps temporarily a little bit with the pain. Ablation can be helpful somewhat. For example, it will slightly increase fertility in a 6-month window.
And just to stop you for a second, ablation is actually burning off these lesions, or?
Perfect. It's just kind of burning them. And we think of it when we do excision, we think of it as just the tip of the iceberg, and that you've got this whole lesion with its neurologic and vascular involvement beneath the surface, and you just burn the surface. So you help temporarily with the chemicals and inflammation on the surface, but you're not really getting at the root of the problem. And sometimes patients will find their pain is even worse. So thank you. Fulguration and ablation are pretty much the same thing, and it's burning of the lesion. Whereas excision attempts to fully excise the lesions and excise the disease without removing the uterus, without removing the organs. However, sometimes it invades the bowel, so you remove a section of bowel or rectum or colon. Sometimes it invades the appendix, and you might remove that. You might take out a little section of bladder if it's invading the bladder. Same with the ureter and the diaphragm. And then occasionally an ovary is so overtaken with endometriosis, it might be better to remove it. But usually you can remove the disease from the ovary and save the ovary. So those are the best well-known treatments.
Right, right.
And what we see increasingly is improved outcomes with excision. For example, excision over ablation, you get 4 times increased pregnancy rates compared to ablation.
Oh, and so it solves the infertility for 4 times the amount of people.
Incredibly, and that we're talking spontaneous fertility, not just IVF. Excision also improves in vitro fertilization.
For more information about endometriosis treatment and pelvic surgery, please visit the website nwendometriosis.com. That's NW. Endometriosis is spelled endometriosis.com. Or you can Google Dr. Shanti Moling. That's Dr. Shanti Moling. S-H-A-N-T-I, Moling, M-O-H-L-I-N-G.